but I'm still hoping I won't be green. He stops walking and stares at me, tipping his head to the side. Yeah, yours is a kind of orangey colour. Ah, phew. I think I see this colour on you because it is the colour of the particular sound of your voice. And also, if I think of you, the beginning of you would be translucent, as that's the colour of the beginning of your name. And then it turns into this orangey colour. So you're like a light orange with a hint of translu... He is interrupted by a topless jogger running past, wearing tiny blue shorts. Reuben gazes after the lanky figure, sweat dripping off the hairs on his back. He glances at me out of the corner of his eye, shakes his head and grins. Definitely not red. Chapter 4. Tommy. Switching Personalities. In 2000, schoolteacher Luke found himself in a terrible situation. He had developed an increasing interest in child pornography. He began acquiring a collection of pornographic magazines and photographs off the internet that focused on children and adolescents. He started soliciting prostitutes at massage parlours. He went to great lengths to conceal his activities. He knew they were completely unacceptable, but later said that the pleasure principle overrode his attempts at restraint. It was only after he started making subtle sexual advances towards his stepdaughter, who subsequently informed his wife, that Luke's paedophilia was discovered and he was arrested for child molestation. The judge told Luke that he had to attend a 12-step program for sex addiction, or face jail. Luke chose the program but was expelled after repeatedly asking the nursing staff for sexual favours. The evening before his sentencing, Luke took himself to the University of Virginia Hospital. He said he had a headache and was scared he was going to rape his landlady. Doctors scanned his brain and dropped a bombshell. There was a tumour the size of an egg in his right orbitofrontal lobe, an area towards the very front of the brain. Although this region can show considerable variation between people, growing evidence suggests that it is involved in working out what rewards or punishment we might receive for specific actions, as well as providing us with drive, motivation and judgment. Surgeons removed the tumour and, just like that, Luke's paedophilia disappeared. After 7 months, he was deemed no risk to the public and returned home to live with his family. A few years later, Luke's paedophilic urges returned. This time, he went straight to hospital. Scans showed his tumour had grown back in the same place. With its removal, his personality once again returned to normal. Few demonstrations of the fragile nature of our personality are as remarkable as Luke's. But changes in personality are not rare. More than 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, a disease that can severely affect a person's personality. Every 3.5 minutes in the UK, someone has a stroke, which can induce temporary or permanent changes in mood, values, and impulsiveness. We tend to think of our personality as something that is steadfast and strong, but in truth, it can rapidly desert us. A few years before I started this book, I struck up an online friendship with a person who had experienced not one, but two completely different personalities. A man called Tommy McHugh, whose behaviour, thoughts and motivations had changed dramatically after a burst blood vessel damaged his brain. But I'd only known one side of him, the person he was after his stroke. So I decided to visit his daughter to find out more about where our personality comes from, and what it is like to experience two in one lifetime. Tommy's story starts with a potato. First, it was just a few plants that showed signs of grey-green spots. Then the spots became bigger, turned brown and rough and firm. Soon, the fungus had spread to nearby crops, finally ravaging whole fields. The Great Potato Famine, as it became known, sparked a period of mass starvation and disease in Ireland that killed more than 1 million people. More than 1 million others emigrated. Between 1845 and 1852, several thousand families settled just across the Irish Sea in Liverpool. But they were far from welcome. Contempt for the Irish was vocalised by Benjamin Disraeli, who served as Prime Minister several years after the famine, when he called them a wild, reckless, indolent, uncertain and superstitious race that have no sympathy with the English character. Their ideal of human felicity, he said, is an alternation of clannish broils and coarse idolatry. As a result of this prejudice, many Irish immigrants faced daily persecution, discrimination and physical attacks. Although Tommy McHugh was born 100 years after the famine, discrimination was still rife in Liverpool. Having a strong Liverpudlian accent did little to hide the fact that Tommy was from a poor Irish family. He quickly learned how to defend himself against the mental and physical abuse thrown at him in school, as did his brothers and sisters, all 12 of them. "We never let any taunting go unpunished," said Tommy when we first spoke over the phone. "I learned to fight with my fists from a very early age." He also learned to hide his emotions, a lesson that came from his dad, whom Tommy described as a grafter but a drinker, never coming home with as much money as he should. As a result, Tommy struggled to stay on the right tracks. "It was a tough life. I was a naughty boy, in and out of school all the time. Drugs, stealing, fighting, I did it all." "Dad would tell us how he had to steal people's shoes because he didn't have any of his own," says Tommy's daughter, Shiloh. "I am at her house in Buckinghamshire, just outside London. It is lunchtime and black clouds are wandering all over the county, darkening the skies. We sit at the kitchen table facing the living room where Shiloh's young son, Isaac, is constructing a large wooden rail track. Rapid bursts of colour flash from the cartoons playing on the television, a treat for Isaac, part of the deal made earlier in return for his patience while I talk with his mum. I ask Shiloh about her father. I want to know what he was like as a dad, what she remembers about his past, what kind of person he used to be. When he was young, it was a case of survival to a huge degree, she says. Dad and the others stole for what they needed. Very few of his brothers weren't in prison at some point or another. He was never emotional, never. Tommy became a building contractor, married his childhood sweetheart, and along came Shiloh and her brother Scott. Despite his lack of formal education, Tommy loved to read. When Shiloh was little, he read her Lord of the Rings. As a teenager, Shiloh reread all three volumes. She remembers feeling disappointed when she found that much of the story she had loved was missing. "I realised that Dad must have made up a load of the chapters. I was like, what about when Bilbo did this or when he met that person?" "When times were good, they were really, really good," Shiloh says. "He'd be fun and entertaining and the dad that all your friends said they wished they had. But then there would be what she refers to as incredibly dark times. Tommy struggled with anger and aggression and often took hard drugs, including heroin. You never knew which dad you were going to get. He could be violent if he was drunk. There would be occasions when we'd be packed up by my mum and taken away and he'd threaten her and say, 'If you leave me, I'll find you and I'll burn the house down.'" Shiloh's voice softens. "But then he was always good at getting everything back on track. Being good and wonderful and talking with you and having lots of fun. It would be like that for a while. Everything would be great, and then the darkness would return." Differences between personalities are clear to see in real life, but incredibly difficult to study objectively. Many scientists attempt the task by defining our personality in terms of traits or patterns of behaviour, thoughts and emotions that are relatively stable over time. The extraordinary variety of personality traits is commonly broken down into the so-called Big Five, namely openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Openness refers to having a general curiosity and willingness to take on new experiences, information, and ideas. Conscientiousness is the ability to regulate your impulses, plan your life, and display self-discipline. Extroverts tend to partake in a breadth of activities, are talkative, assertive, and happy to be the centre of attention. If you have a high level of agreeableness, you value getting along with others, so you may be more willing to compromise. You are kind, generous, and considerate. Finally, neuroticism is a measure of how anxious you are, and your general tendency to experience negative emotions. The degree to which each of these traits exist in an individual is thought to predict their personality. But what causes us to express these traits? Is our personality a product of our genes or our environment? To find out, we need to travel to Ohio, once the home of two very unusual brothers. Jim Lewis and Jim Springer were identical twins, separated just weeks after they were born, renamed by their adoptive parents and raised apart. When they were reunited 39 years later, they discovered that their name was not all they had in common. they both suffered from tension headaches, bit their nails, worked in law enforcement, enjoyed woodworking, smoked Salem cigarettes, and they drove the same car. They holidayed at the same beach in Florida. They both married women named Linda, only to divorce and remarry a woman named Betty. Both men have sons, called James Allen Lewis and James Allen Springer. They both even called their family dog Toy. Was it just a coincidence? The behavioural geneticist and evolutionary psychologist Nancy Segal at California State University Fullerton says there is more to it than that. The Jim twins story was the catalyst for a groundbreaking experiment called the Minnesota Study of Twins Reared Apart, initiated in 1979. Over the course of 20 years, researchers at the University of Minnesota followed the lives of twins who were separated at birth. They studied 137 pairs of twins in all, 81 pairs of identical twins who had come from one egg that had split into two, and 56 pairs of fraternal twins who arose from two different eggs. Several researchers, including Segal, analysed data from the study, along with data from a separate registry of twins who were raised together. They came to a remarkable conclusion, that identical twins raised apart were as identical in personality as those raised together. Some traits, including leadership, obedience to authority, resilience to stress and fearfulness, were more than 50% influenced by their genes. The results imply that a child who is genetically predisposed to being shy may become more or less shy through their upbringing, but is unlikely to become an incredibly extroverted adult. "It was really surprising," said Segal, when I asked her whether she predicted such a dramatic result. "We expected to see more differences between the identical twins who were raised apart, but we just couldn't find them." These studies have had their fair share of critics. One long-held complaint was that twins may have similar personalities merely because they look so much alike, which would tend to elicit the same sorts of behaviour from other people. In 2013, Segal found a way to test this theory. If true that physical appearance triggers a specific treatment by others, then the personality similarities of doppelgangers, people who look alike but have different genes, should be as similar as identical twins. To find out, Segal recruited 23 pairs of doppelgangers from a project by the French-Canadian photographer François Brunel, who had been creating black-and-white portraits of doppelgangers for years. Each participant was given a questionnaire that assessed their personality using the Big Five traits, as well as other aspects of their behaviour, such as self-esteem. The result? Doppelgangers did not share significant personality traits and were significantly less alike in personality than both identical and non-identical twins raised together or apart. So is it their shared genetic history that explains the number of similarities between the Jim twins? "It's not that there's a specific gene that will make us want to holiday at the same beach," says Segal. "But why do you choose a beach holiday? It might be because you react badly to the cold, or that you are very sociable, so like crowded places. These things are partly a function of your genetic tendencies. Taken collectively, they might explain why you're more likely to choose one holiday destination over all the others." In the nature-nurture debate, though, nurture still has a fundamental role to play. One of the most impressive demonstrations of the environment's influence on personality came from a series of studies conducted at King's College London in the 1990s by Robert Plomin and his colleagues, which showed that unique life experiences had the greatest influence on well-being and depression in identical and non-identical twins. None of these studies are perfect, but the results suggest that we don't inherit a blueprint on which our personalities are permanently stamped. Our genes may predispose us to certain paths, but our personalities can be shaped by environment over a lifetime. And sometimes they can change overnight. Tommy had been suffering from a headache. It just wouldn't go away. But that wasn't unusual. He was often found with a belt tied around his head, he told me, trying to alleviate a migraine that would keep him locked up for weeks. He was on the toilet, reading the paper when it happened. "I suddenly felt an explosion in the left-hand side of my head and ended up on the floor. I think the only thing that kept me conscious was not wanting to be found with my pants down. I stood and pulled my trousers up, then the other side of my head went bang." Tommy had experienced a subarachnoid hemorrhage due to a ruptured aneurysm. Burst blood vessels had sent blood squirting in and around his brain. He was discovered by Jan, his second wife, and rushed to hospital, where surgeons operated on him for 11 hours. Doctors warned Shiloh and her family that it might be a long time before he woke up. "Once," says Shiloh, "Dad had to go work in Saudi Arabia for a while. I must have been about 3 or 4. He'd write to me all the time, every 2 or 3 days. When I was 13, I was looking at the envelopes from those letters, and I noticed that all the stamps were from Liverpool. I asked Mum why, and she said it was because Dad would give them to people to take back to England, and then they'd post them from there." Although doctors had managed to stem the bleed in Tommy's brain, there was no doubt that some damage had been done. His doctors were pleased to see him sitting up in bed just days after the operation. Unfortunately, there was an unexpected complication. "As soon as I woke up, I knew immediately that something was different," said Tommy. "My mind had changed totally and dramatically." "I was 16 when I found out about the prison sentence," says Shiloh. "I'd just started college, and this girl was saying they lived next door to a McHugh. Everyone knew a McHugh because there were so many of them. Anyway, she said that all of them had been in prison. One had even been in for murder. I went home and asked what was going on, and found out Dad hadn't been in Saudi Arabia. He'd been in prison." A single fingerprint had been discovered on a fraudulent check. It was Tommy's. He claimed this wasn't possible because the finger it came from had been severed in a fight that he'd had when he was 16. Ever since, that particular finger had stuck up at a weird angle, unable to bend. "He always denied the charge," says Shiloh. She hesitates, and I can't work out whether she believes it or not. "He said that the finger could never have touched a check. But at the same time, he had done so much bad stuff that he said they were always going to catch him on something, so it might as well be this." I asked Tommy to describe how he felt when he woke from his surgery. "I was totally emotional for a start," he said, "and I just couldn't imagine hurting a fly." Tommy looked around his hospital ward and through the window to the grounds outside. "I could see the beauty in everything. I had all these thoughts in my head that I'd never had before. I suddenly had these emotions and cares and worries. I could taste the femininity inside of me." "It was like two different people," says Shiloh. "He was incredibly emotional. He'd cry at the drop of a hat. He'd be sad. He'd be happy. The person he was before seemed to have just disappeared." Tommy's sudden appreciation of the beauty of the world and his new emotional compass weren't the only changes he was experiencing. Looking out of his hospital window, he saw a tree sprouting numbers. "I thought I must have misheard. You saw numbers out there on the tree?" I asked. "No, they were numbers in my mind," he said. "The numbers 3, 6, and 9. Then I couldn't stop talking in rhyme." "Rhyme?" "Yeah, I had this urge to rhyme all the time." He laughed. "There I go again. I was spouting poetry left, right, and centre. New stuff, old stuff. I wander lonely as a cloud. I can recite poetry upside down, sideways, on an angle. You name it, I'll say it." A month passed and Tommy was well enough to go home. It wasn't wholly obvious to his doctors what was wrong with him. Although they knew that his hemorrhage had lightly damaged parts of his brain, during his emergency surgery they'd had to insert a metal clip to stop the bleeding, which meant he wasn't able to have any more scans to pinpoint the exact regions of damage. Tommy described his brain as having gone into overdrive. "If I go for a walk inside my brain, I see all this information," he said. "Angles, languages, structures, mathematics, wild, colourful pictures. Everything I look at sparks 6 memories or emotions or smells that each spinning in my mind just for a moment, and then it's like one of those thoughts crashes against the other, and that sparks 6 different thoughts, and then the corners of those thoughts touch and create 6 more. I'm constantly bombarded with patterns and details and information and faces. It's like walking inside a corridor of endless, endless information. My brain is like bees in a hive," he continued, barely taking a breath. "In the middle, all you see are honeycomb cells covered in cling film. When you stroke these little honeycomb cells, lots of other cells break out from it, like a lightning flash touching a brain cell. And from that cell comes a volcano emitting fairy liquid bubbles with billions and billions of images. They're pouring out like Mount Etna. They never stop. Each of these bubbles contains another 1,000,000 images. That's just a split second in my mind. I feel like I've been shown just how endless the brain is. It's inconceivable. We use such a tiny percentage of it." I tried to interrupt, but he went on. My brain is filled with endless details, but I'm too uneducated to understand all the information that's popping up inside there. It's telling me that there are all these different languages, all this knowledge, pinpricks of it, microscopic hints of it all, so that if I wanted to use it, it would be there for me to use. I feel like I could talk Italian if the right thing triggered it. It's all within me. I feel like we've all got these sweeping talents in our brain, but we don't know that they are there because we've never been forced to use them. That's my vision of what I see in my brain. More explanations followed. I was having trouble getting a word in edgeways. As had become clear within 5 minutes of speaking with him, this constant bombardment of thoughts and associations was reflected in Tommy's speech. His mind travelled rapidly from one concept to the next. His thoughts turned on a sixpence. Tommy would often send me pages of emails with things that he had forgotten to tell me in our telephone conversations. Some of them were written normally, some were written as verse. The descriptions that he would weave into his speech were sometimes fanciful, sometimes insightful. He regularly came across as wise, yet when I listened back to recordings of our conversations, his metaphors were often ambiguous and disjointed. "I feel like I've been unplugged from the matrix," he said one day. "Suddenly I've been disconnected from the old life that was showing me things just as someone in charge wanted me to see them. I'm glad I'm a bit stupid, Helen," he said. "Otherwise I would see reality far too much." Understandably, Tommy's family were finding his endless prose, philosophical musings and gentler manner a little difficult to get used to. "He was incredibly different," says Shiloh. "His whole world was tipped upside down." Everyone assumed that given enough time to recover, he would change back to the person he had once been, that they'd see a glimpse of the darkness again, but it never happened. Not everyone welcomed the new Tommy. Some people wanted him to be the person he was before. Some embraced the person he had become, but drifted away, finding they had little in common. Others feared it was just an act. A lot of his brothers wanted him to turn back to who he was, Shiloh says. One in particular always tried to pull him back into trouble. Tommy's first wife, Shiloh's mum, also found it hard to accept the new Tommy. "Even 10 years after the strokes, my mum still didn't believe he could really have changed," says Shiloh. She still believed that bad person was in there somewhere. How is it then that our personality can change so dramatically? To understand that, first we have to drop a notion consistently repeated in popular culture that we are either left or right-brained. This theory was born in the winter of 1962, when William Jenkins, a military veteran, was being prepped for surgery at White Memorial Medical Center in Los Angeles. His doctor, Roger Sperry, a renowned neuroscientist, was preparing to split Jenkins' brain in half. Jenkins had been hurt in an explosion during the Second World War, and ever since had experienced up to 10 seizures a day. Sperry believed that by cutting through the corpus callosum, the structure that connects the two sides of the brain, he could relieve Jenkins of his seizures. Experiments in animals suggested that this would not damage his cognition, that each side of the brain could work independently from the other. The surgery was a success, and Jenkins' cognition was, on the surface, unchanged. But further experiments on him and other split-brain patients were revealing. They proved, for instance, that the left-hand side of the brain controls the right-hand side of the body, and vice versa. The studies also demonstrated for the first time that the left and right hemispheres specialise in different tasks. For example, the left side of the brain is much more talkative than the right, which can produce only rudimentary words and phrases. It is more analytical and is better at maths. The right-hand side deals with space, directions and music. It is much better at recognising faces and allows you to understand the emotional content of language. The work earned Sperry a Nobel Prize in 1981, and soon afterwards a new theory of personality was born. It proposed that whichever side of your brain dominated determined whether you were logical and analytical or creative and emotional. Even today, it is common to see the theory referred to in the popular press. In fact, while the brain does indeed have discrete regions, each with a specific role, there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that any side dominates in the healthy brain. Think about language, for instance. Although the left side of the brain helps us to generate complex speech, the right-hand side gives it some finesse. Take the phrase, "I'll show you the ropes." The left side of the brain is needed to produce the correct word order, but the right side of the brain provides you with the ability to understand and produce the verbal metaphor. Rather than think about ourselves as being left or right-brained, says Stephen Kozlin, an emeritus professor at Harvard University, we should be thinking about ourselves in terms of our top and bottom brain, specifically how the two interact. The top parts of the brain include most of the frontal cortex and the parietal lobes. The bottom parts involve some of the frontal cortex, but mostly the temporal and occipital lobes. When we split the brain up in this way, we can generalise about their roles, says Kozlin. The top brain formulates plans and puts them into action, while the bottom brain interprets incoming information about the world and gives it meaning. It's vital to remember that we use both parts of the brain all of the time, says Kozlin. They are a single system. It's how they interact that's important. For example, when I see my dad across the pub, I recognise him because the bottom parts of my brain interpret the sensory input I'm getting from my eyes and give it context, which unlocks a memory of my dad. As we discovered in Chapter 1, that memory is connected to other memories, which enables me to bring to mind the fact that he enjoys playing tennis, drinks Harvey's Best Bitter, and has a soft spot for Camilla Parker Bowles. But that's not all I need from my dad. I might want to invite him to a quiz night or ask his advice as an accountant. This is where my top brain speaks up. Devising and carrying out plans is its job, but it can't do this alone. It needs to receive information from the bottom brain about the thing I'm going to speak to him about and how I feel about it in order to figure out a plan of action and then execute it. If that plan isn't quite working, my top brain will check in with the bottom brain again and adjust its actions to correct any mistakes. The key to Kozlin's theory is that in some situations, we rely on the top or bottom to a greater or lesser degree. Which one dominates characterises our personality. For instance, if we thoroughly utilise both our top and bottom brain, we're inclined to carry out plans and think about the consequences in detail. But if the bottom brain system dominates, we're more likely to think about what we see around us in a lot of depth, interpreting the minutiae of an experience or the consequences of an event. Someone acting in this mode is less likely to act on all of this information and execute a plan. On the other hand, if your top brain system dominates, you're more likely to be a go-getter, a person who may be seen as creative and proactive, but you're less likely to think about the consequences. Kozlin calls it the bull in the china shop mode. When neither top nor bottom brains dominate, a person doesn't get caught up in the detail of an experience nor initiate future plans. Instead, they're very much of the moment, says Kozlin. They let external events dictate their actions. They're a team player. Not everybody can be president. You need people who are like soldiers, not looking beneath the surface of their actions, just getting on and doing what needs to be done at that precise moment. If you want to find out which mode dominates in your brain, Kozlin has devised a test you can take online. In his book, Top Brain, Bottom Brain, Surprising Insights into How You Think, Kozlin says that his theory can explain why we see sudden changes in personality. Take Phineas Gage as an example. As we discovered earlier, Gage suffered a terrible accident when a tamping iron shot through his skull. Historical notes suggest that before the accident, Gage was unusually resourceful, that he was a good planner who learned from his experiences. It allowed him to work his way up the construction trade after barely any formal education. After his accident, there were profound changes in his personality. He would utter gross profanities and devise numerous plans that would immediately be abandoned for others. After Gage passed away, his skull was donated to science and is now sitting in a small glass box at Harvard Medical School's Warren Anatomical Museum. Using the skull, researchers reconstructed the damage that occurred to his brain. They discovered that around 11% of the axons, the longest part of the nerve through which electrical impulses propagate, in his frontal cortex had been destroyed. This meant that a number of connections were severed between his frontal cortex, high up in the brain, and areas lower down. It was not just that the trauma damaged specific behaviours, such as his ability to suppress verbal profanities, writes Kozlin. The damage also impaired how his top and bottom brain worked together. Whereas Gage previously had been strategic and thoughtful, he was now impulsive and unstable. His bottom brain apparently interrupted his top brain inappropriately, impairing his ability to stick to plans or revise them after receiving new feedback on their effects. He was left awash in a sea of fluctuating emotions and was incapable of responding appropriately. I wondered, could this theory also explain what was going on in Tommy's brain? To find out, I decided to speak to somebody else who had developed a close relationship with Tommy after his accident, Alice Flaherty, a neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Tommy had written to Flaherty soon after recovering from his operation to ask whether she could tell him anything more about his new personality. "He was such an attractive person," said Flaherty, when I asked her about their initial correspondence. "His letters were incredibly charming." Flaherty tried to get Tommy over to her lab in the US, but he couldn't get a visa due to his previous criminal convictions. In the end, she travelled over to Liverpool for a few days. "I just loved him," she said. "He had this inability to hurt anyone. He was like a Jane monk who sweeps the ground ahead as he walks to avoid injuring bugs. He took care of every stray cat in the neighbourhood. He used to have this tough guy mask, and suddenly he was a softie, in a lovely way." Flaherty isn't keen on using Coslin's top and bottom brain theories to hypothesise about what happened to Tommy. Instead, she has made inferences based on what we know about where the areas of damage occurred. In Tommy's case, we know that his stroke occurred in the middle cerebral artery, which supplies a portion of the frontal and temporal lobes, says Flaherty. "Although it is a matter of conjecture, the damage to his temporal lobes is the most likely explanation for his sudden obsession with the detail in the world. To understand why, we have to look at how the brain deals with the bewildering amount of sensory information around us. We see shapes and colours and movements and hear sounds and smells all the time, yet rarely pay much attention to them. When I walk into the pub to meet my dad, I might notice the smell from the kitchen or the football on the television at first, but within seconds these stimuli disappear. We filter out familiar and irrelevant information. If we didn't, our senses would be bombarded with too much information and we wouldn't be able to concentrate on the job at hand. In order to do this, sensory data passes into the temporal lobes, which perform an emotional surveillance of sorts, telling other parts of the cerebral cortex whether the information is worth thinking about or not. Only the most relevant of data is sent up to the frontal lobes, which are then able to formulate plans, execute actions, and initiate speech based on that information. Tommy's behaviour suggested that his brain had stopped filtering the irrelevant stimuli that are usually screened out of our conscious awareness. His temporal lobes were no longer judging all of his sensory data or ideas critically enough, says Flaherty, so they all pass muster and float into his consciousness. We often see people with lesions in their temporal lobes losing their understanding of speech but talking loads more than normal, explains Flaherty. They've basically become less judgmental about what they're saying. We call it politician talk. Lots of words, but no content. In contrast, Tommy's new emotional compass was more likely due to damage to the frontal lobes. These regions form connections with and inhibit emotional areas towards the lower and middle areas of the brain. The level of activity in the frontal lobes can affect our personality in many ways. In the 1960s, the German psychologist Hans Eysenck proposed that introverts may have more self-control than extroverts because their cortex is higher in arousal, meaning it is more sensitive and responsive to incoming information. This higher level of arousal keeps in check their emotional areas underneath. You can test for yourself whether you are more introverted or extroverted. Place one end of a cotton bud on your tongue for 20 seconds. Next, put a few drops of lemon onto your tongue before placing the other end of the cotton bud on your tongue for another 20 seconds. Tie a piece of thread around the middle of the cotton bud and see whether the lemon juice end is lower due to being heavier from excess saliva. If so, you may be more introverted. Your higher arousal state meant that you reacted more strongly to the lemon, which made you salivate more than usual. Eysenck used a version of this test to support his theory by showing that people who score higher on the other measures of introversion also produce more saliva. A similar thing happens when you try to knock out an introvert with anaesthetic. They need more to send them to sleep than an extrovert would. If you're still not convinced, think about how stimulants like Ritalin are given to children with ADHD to calm them down, and how sedatives like alcohol make people briefly more chatty and emotional. Although it is a matter of conjecture, it seems that communication between Tommy's frontal lobes and lower brain areas had become impaired. Like Gage, damage to the frontal lobes seemed to have lifted the brake on his emotional brain areas below. Overnight, he gained access to emotions he said he hadn't previously known existed. Tommy's wife Jan thought that all these words, thoughts and emotions might be best placed on paper. So a few weeks after Tommy had been discharged from hospital, she encouraged him to pick up a paintbrush. Maybe drawing what was in his mind might help focus his thoughts. But once Tommy started painting, he couldn't stop. At first it was just lots of A4 pieces of paper taped to the wall, says Shiloh. We encouraged it because we all just thought it was part of his recovery. It was really helping. But soon Tommy ran out of canvases. First he bought more, but then that started getting too expensive, so he took to painting directly onto the walls of his house. Once he had covered all the walls in one room, he'd move on to the next. Once those were done, he'd move on to the floor, the tables and the chairs. Then he'd start all over again. We didn't live with him, so didn't see it daily, but you'd go round and pretty much every month the house had completely changed. All the walls, the floor, everything, says Shiloh. The paint on the chimney breast was about 2 inches thick because he'd just paint layer upon layer of art over the top of each other. What's in my brain is painted on these walls, Tommy said. The tables, the ceiling, the doors, in sculptures, in metal, in stone, everything is poured out of my brain. I empty it onto my canvases with the colour and pictures and scenes, and I never stop. Tommy was painting for 21 hours a day. We had to remind him to eat and sleep, Shiloh says. As long as he could paint and sculpt, nothing else seemed to matter much. Tommy sent some pictures of his artwork to me. One was of two faces with images pouring out of them. That painting was what he felt, said Shiloh, when I described it to her. This drive, this desire, it was uncontainable. It was like looking at all these things that were firing in his brain that he couldn't control. Was he happy to see you when you came round to visit? I asked. Yes, he'd say that he missed us, and it was lovely to see us, and he'd be this wonderful person. But after a while, you'd know the time had come to leave because he'd get fidgety. He'd want to get back to his painting. The moment you walked out the door, it was like you didn't exist. Tommy's endless creativity eventually drove Jan away. I don't blame her, said Tommy. I was a completely different person. It was hard, says Shiloh. We all felt a little pushed out by his art, but we just accepted it. It was doing him so much good. I asked Tommy whether his sudden love of art took him by surprise. Had he had any interest in it before? No, I'd never even picked up a paintbrush, he said. Never been in an art gallery, he added, as an afterthought. Except maybe to steal something. Flaherty knows personally what it is like to have a sudden and uncontrollable urge to do something creative. Following the death of her premature twins, she suffered from postpartum mania. I couldn't sleep. All I wanted to do was talk, but because I'm an introvert, I started writing it down instead, she told me. Some primitive area of my brain was saying, "Holy shit, something's gone wrong, you've got to do something." She was flooded with ideas and for 4 months could do nothing but write. She realised that her mania resembled something called hypergraphia, which can occur alongside epilepsy and result in the intense desire to write. She decided to write a book about her experiences. "My writing a book was a way to understand myself," she said. "But also, if you're writing all the time and no one reads it, then you're just crazy. But if you're an author, then it's a good thing." A year later, history repeated itself and she again gave birth to premature twins, though thankfully this time they survived. But once again she suddenly had the uncontrollable urge to write, mixed with periods of depression. Over the years, medication and exercise have helped her control the condition. The emergence of an uncontrollable creative drive has been termed sudden artistic output. It means that the brain can no longer inhibit certain behaviours. Tommy is one of a handful of famous cases in the scientific literature. Another is John Sarkin, who in 1989 suffered a traumatic hemorrhage after an operation to fix a blood vessel that was pressing on his auditory nerve, making his ears ring. Months into his rehabilitation, John started to draw. Months turned into years, and he became consumed by the need to paint all the time. He sold his chiropractor's office and became a full-time artist whose work can sell for $10,000 apiece. Then there's Tony Sicoria, an orthopaedic surgeon who lives in upstate New York. In 1994, he was at a lake for a family gathering when he went to a payphone to call his mum. Moments after he ended the call, a bolt of lightning struck him and he crashed to the ground. A nearby nurse brought him round with CPR. A month after the accident, Sicoria had returned to work, mostly feeling fit and well, when over a period of a few days he was overcome with a desire to listen to piano music. He began to teach himself how to play the piano and later began to hear music playing constantly in his head. Neurological scans at the time showed nothing amiss, and when offered newer techniques he politely declined, stating that his music was a blessing and not something that he desired to question. In 2013, I came across another case of sudden artistic output in a paper that described a woman who had arrived at a hospital in the UK complaining of memory problems and a tendency to lose her way in familiar locations. She was diagnosed with epilepsy and treated with the drug lamotrigine. As her seizures receded, a strange behaviour took hold. She began compulsively to write poetry. She often used irregular rhythm and rhyme for comic effect, a style her husband described as doggerel. I have one of her poems framed in my study. To tidy out cupboards is morally wrong. I sing you this song, I tell you I'm right. Each time that I've done it, thrown all out of sight, I've regretted it. Think of the treasures now lost to the world, measureless gold, riches unfurled. Diamonds, sapphires, rubies, emeralds, you must have had them, all tucked well away. So, to tidy out cupboards, throw rubbish from sight, even the poems you write up at night, is morally wrong, so I'm keeping this one. The relationship between art and brain damage is a complex one. The reasons suggested for these rare cases of sudden artistic output are speculative at best, but Flaherty proposes that they may include an increase in dopamine. Dopamine is used all over the brain and is important for motivation and producing a drive towards things that make you happy. If you have too much dopamine, though, it can lead to disinhibited behaviour. Those affected might start gambling, partake in riskier activities, and show compulsive behaviours, including a sudden urge to draw or play music. It is a side effect that has been noted in people with Parkinson's who are on high doses of L-DOPA, a drug that increases dopamine to replace that loss through the disease. Disinhibition of brain pathways is also seen in Tourette's syndrome, whereby people find it difficult to suppress inappropriate words and noises. Interestingly, this behaviour is often accompanied by a substantial creative drive. It's not possible to say exactly what Tommy's trigger was, says Flaherty. Perhaps a stream of ideas and concepts was his muse. Perhaps an increase in dopamine created the obsession. Perhaps putting paintbrush to paper helped him make sense of it all. Whatever the cause, she says, it was clear that painting gave him an extreme sense of well-being. I often wondered whether Tommy's new personality allowed him to reflect on how he used to be, how he had treated his family. But despite having told me about several aspects of his past, his childhood, the drugs and the fights, when I asked him these questions, he said he remembered almost nothing about his old life. I sometimes hear my mammy's voice, he said, and suddenly get a taste of a past. But it's not really remembering. People have told me about my life by their stories, but I don't know what the hell they're talking about. You don't remember how you used to act? I asked. No, when I woke up I found it difficult to recognise people. Bits about my childhood came back, but not everything. I found out a lot through stories that people tell me, but sometimes I think they've made the stories into a kind of Chinese whispers. Their stories become bigger, so I take no notice of them. My memory starts at 2001. But when I ask Shiloh about this apparent memory loss, she tells a different story. Dad would often apologise for how he had been in the past, she says. He would always say that his memory wasn't that great, but in reality, if you were reminiscing about the past, his memory was incredibly good. I think in reality, he just didn't want to spend too much time delving into his memory to see what was there. He didn't want to fully remember who he was before because he was so emotional after the accident, the things he'd done would have been a lot harder to deal with. I asked Tommy whether he preferred his new personality to what he remembers of the old one. The best thing that happened to Tommy McHugh, he said, was having a stroke while doing a poo. I laughed. You just have to accept this alien, unknown identity, he said. Then you adapt and start to live again. Tommy said he felt that during his rehabilitation, a lot of his doctors were trying to find the old Tommy, rather than embrace the new one. Helen, none of this is just about me, he said. There's a world of people like me living out these strange new worlds of brain repair, and a lot of them don't have anything or anybody to help them express what's going on. Tommy was so impassioned by this issue that he started giving talks to other stroke survivors to encourage them to embrace their new mind rather than trying to capture all of the aspects of their old one. Our brain is repairing itself, and sometimes that's in new, constructive ways, and sometimes it's in negative ways. We need to be able to talk about the strange things that happen to us, because getting a bit of support and understanding in recovery can make 100% difference. What a lot of people forget is that we're alive. We've survived this really hard adventure. Those of us who have had strokes and can walk and talk need to let other people know that it's not the end of the world. It's a beginning. A chance to improve one's mind and not be put on a shelf and labelled as a brain-damaged buffoon. I asked Shiloh whether she thinks her dad seemed happier after the stroke. Definitely, she says. His old behaviour was a result of this heaviness that he felt. There used to be this switch in his head that you'd see when he would suddenly realise he had gone too far and he'd think, she whispers as Isaac is in earshot, I fucked up. I might as well go the whole way and take everybody down with me. He would ruin everything because he'd thought he'd already gone too far into this lonely, dark and scary place. After his strokes, he was certainly a much more balanced, settled, happier person. He liked himself, whereas I don't think he did before. No matter how frustrated he got, he never got dark. He never let it send him down. He'd just step back and take another route. It took us a long time to accept that there wasn't going to be any more dark times. Redemption. That's what it came down to, says Shiloh suddenly, as the rain begins to fall heavily against the kitchen window, and I notice how late it has got. It was a chance for him to make things right, to make up somehow, perhaps unconsciously, for the dark times that he had once led. People think a horrific brain injury is the end, and I'm not so sure it was for Dad. It gave him a fresh start, and there's not many people who are capable of having that in life. He was able to wipe the slate clean, and he took advantage of that. He started again as a good person. It's not often that we take the time to consider our personality, who we are, and how we make our choices. Perhaps it's because we tend to think our personalities are innate, that they are what they are. I can't help wondering whether knowing more about the mechanisms that help to build them could help us navigate life a little more successfully. Perhaps even make us all a little happier. In 2007, a team led by Anita Woolley answered part of this question. She started by giving almost 2,500 people a questionnaire that assessed their ability to think about the properties of objects or their spatial location, a method that allowed her to figure out whether they were top-brainers or bottom-brainers. For example, participants were asked to recount what someone had been wearing at a recent dinner party, an answer that is accomplished primarily using the bottom brain, which stores visual memories of colour and shapes. They were also asked questions that involved spatial manipulation, such as imagining how the Statue of Liberty might look if rotated. This spatial imagery is accomplished primarily by the top brain. Woolley's team then chose 200 people who scored highly in the top brain tasks, but low in the bottom brain tasks, or vice versa. Next, they split the group into pairs and asked them to navigate a virtual maze. At various sections of the maze were little greebles. Greebles are computer-generated objects that don't obviously resemble anything in real life. Sometimes a particular greeble would pop up twice in different parts of the maze. One of the pair had to navigate the maze using a joystick. The other was tasked with tagging duplicated greebles of the same shape. Unbeknown to the volunteers, each was given a role that suited their strengths or deliberately went against them. So in some trials, a person who was great at using their spatial top brain would be asked to navigate, and their partner, a bottom brainer who was good at object recognition, would tag greebles. In the opposite condition, their roles were reversed. In a final set of experiments, both people in the pair were top or bottom brainers. As you might expect, when the roles were suited to their brains, the teams performed best. But here's the rub. This occurred only when the task was completed in silence. In trials where the pairs were allowed to talk to each other, the incompatible teams suddenly did as well as those who were naturally suited to their tasks. When the researchers watched back the trials, they discovered that each person quickly took over the other's role, helping them to achieve their assignment. In other words, complete strangers had spontaneously discovered their strengths and weaknesses and modified the behaviour to get a job done. Funnily enough, when two people who were both top-brainers or both bottom-brainers were allowed to talk, their results suffered more than when they worked in silence. Two people with the same abilities, trying to help each other with something neither was good at, just made matters worse. What this experiment suggests is that it's useful to know what kind of personality traits we possess, whether it's using the Big Five or Coslin's top brain and bottom brain modes. With that knowledge, we can be more productive both at work and at home. While none of us would want to experience a personality change as dramatic as Tommy's, we may want to tweak our personalities every now and then to suit a particular challenge better. For instance, if you come across a problem that you can't solve, try thinking about it using the kind of strategy that doesn't come easily to you. It takes more effort to think in a different mode, says Coslin, but anyone can drop into any mode if you really try. Or, like the people in Woolley's experiment, you could augment your skills and knowledge by working with people who have the skills that you lack. It's like you've borrowed a part of your companion's brain, says Coslin, and by doing so extended your own reach and capacities. When I returned home from Shiloh's, I took Coslin's online test to see what part of my brain dictated my life. It suggested that I have a strong tendency to rely on my top brain and a lesser tendency to ignore my bottom brain. It rang true. I thoroughly enjoyed making plans and carrying them out, but I am often too quick to pass over the finer details. My husband is the complete opposite. He is strongly bottom brain biased. He's very good at thinking about the details, but shies away from using them to initiate any plans. That particular trait used to frustrate me, but now I'm starting to see our relative skills and efficiencies in a different light. Together, our personalities make the perfect team. In September 2012, a few months after our final correspondence, and more than a year before I would come to meet his daughter, Tommy died of liver disease. When I heard of his death, I reread all of our conversations, emails, and letters. The last email I ever received seemed a good place to start. You have a new message from Tommy McHugh too. I look at my reflection in the mirror, Helen. A stranger I see, but a happy one. Love to all. Chapter 5. Sylvia, An Endless Hallucination. Avinash Ujjayib was alone, trekking across a vast white glacier in the Karakoram, a mountain range on the edge of the Himalayan plateau known as the Roof of the World. Earlier that morning, he had left his two companions after feeling too exhausted to finish the journey to the summit. Faced with no option but to head back to camp, he set off down the mountain. He had been walking for hours, yet his silent surroundings gave little hint that he was making progress. Suddenly, everything changed. A gigantic icy boulder loomed close one moment, then far away the next. He glanced from left to right, but couldn't shake the feeling that he was looking at the world over his own shoulder. Concentrating on placing one foot in front of the other, he set himself small goals of reaching the next ridge or rocky outcrop. It seemed to take an hour to get from one checkpoint to the next, yet when he looked at his watch, only minutes had passed. As a doctor, Ujjayib made a mental checklist. He wasn't dehydrated, nor did he have altitude sickness. He checked his heart rate and blood pressure. They were completely normal. So why couldn't he shake the notion that he was dead? Ujjayib was experiencing a vivid and prolonged hallucination, something that before 1838 was simply referred to as a wandering mind. It was the French psychiatrist Jean-Étienne Escurel who first characterised the hallucination when he described it as something experienced by someone who has a thorough conviction of the perception of a sensation when a non-external object suited to excite this sensation has impressed upon his senses. Or in other words, who saw something that wasn't really there. Hallucinations aren't limited to images. They can appear as music, voices, and even smells. They can last for seconds or for months, and are likely to have shaped our culture, religion, and societies for centuries. In his book Hallucinations, Oliver Sacks wonders whether Lilliputian hallucinations, in which objects, people or animals seem smaller than they should be in real life, may have given rise to the elves, imps and leprechauns in our folklore. He suggests that terrifying hallucinations of a malign presence may have sparked the idea of demons,